If you believe strongly in the idea of a soulmate, that's not a bad thing so long as your relationship is going well. So if you strongly think that you're with a good partner, they're your ideal fit, you might actually do things like protect your relationship more against threats and show some kind of positive cognitive biases. But the real risk is that.
Welcome to SciSection. My name is Timur Bigaliev, and I'm the journalist for the SciSection radio show broadcasted on CFMU 93.3 FM radio station. We are here today with Dr. Jessica Maxwell. Dr. Maxwell researches relationships and sex and is an assistant professor at McMaster University in Ontario. Thank you so much for coming on here, Dr. Maxwell.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
So how does psychological literature define what a soulmate is?
Yeah, it's a great question. I feel like there's no one right definition. And so really in psychology, I feel like we try to stay away from the concept of a soulmate, but we do know that people say things like, I want to find the one. So I'd say the closest thing that we talk about in the literature would be finding a compatible partner, or sometimes we talk about things like ideal fit or ideal partner preferences. But I'd say overall, kind of the idea of a soulmate would be closest to the idea of a highly compatible partner. But there are some kind of theories that do still use the word soulmate.
I was reading the Merriam-Webster and the Oxford Dictionary definitions, and I saw that they define soulmate as someone who's ideally suited to their partner. And that was interesting to me because I lacked the predestination elements of two souls meeting one another.
Yeah, that is interesting. And sorry, maybe state that definition again, because I feel like there's some interesting pieces that we could unpack. Like, I think you said it is like that you find someone who's ideally suited. Is that what you said?
Yeah, ideally suited to their partner.
Interesting. And I feel like that's kind of really a nebulous concept, right? Because what does ideally suited mean? So that could mean that you're similar in a lot of respects. It could mean that maybe you're having some complementary features in other respects. And one of the things I'm sure will be a theme of this is that we don't actually always know who's ideally suited for us. And in fact, the more satisfied you get with the relationship, you end up shifting your ideals to match your partner. So right now, if someone's single, they might say, my, you know, soulmate who's ideally suited to me is really athletic. But if they actually meet someone and get in a relationship and that person's not so athletic, usually what'll happen is they might now say, oh, the person that's ideally suited to me is humorous or kind or things that are actually true of their current partner. So yeah, I think that definition is kind of interesting to think about.
Are there people who report that they have met their soulmate? And if so, did they click immediately with their partner? Or was it possible that they grew into liking someone so much that they would consider them as a soulmate?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think there are definitely people who, you know, say they've met their soulmate or the one. And in the romantic relationship literature, we often call this soulmate beliefs or destiny belief. And so I think people who typically really strongly endorse that ideology would say that they actually met their soulmate, like they knew that their soulmate was their soulmate right away, that they clicked immediately. And although not always the case, but I'd say typically that's in contrast to the idea that you could kind of grow to appreciate someone as your soulmate. I specifically do a lot of research on destiny and growth beliefs. And so the destiny beliefs would really be that idea that we all have one soulmate and we can tell early on if a relationship's destined to succeed or not. Whereas people who endorse stronger growth beliefs are more the idea that you could make a relationship, like one of the items is essentially like I could make a relationship with almost anybody work. So for them, I think they really think that they could work to appreciate someone as a soulmate. So I think typically though, it really is the case that if you think you need to work on relationship, you don't really endorse that typical soulmate type ideology.
And what are the differences in relationships between people who believe that a soulmate is developed by growing together, or they believe that a soulmate must instantly click?
Yeah, that's a great question. Because I would say like you can simultaneously hold the belief in soulmates whilst holding the belief that we need to work on relationships. But typically, those things are negatively correlated. So what I mean by that is like, usually, if you think you need to really work to develop relationships and connections, you usually don't actually use the word soulmate, because you kind of think that you could just work with anybody. But there are people who do believe that you need to work on relationships and believe in soulmates. And so really what we find in the literature is that if you believe strongly in the idea of a soulmate, that's not a bad thing so long as your relationship is going well. So if you strongly think that you're with a good partner, they're your ideal fit, you might actually do things like protect your relationship more against threats and show some kind of positive cognitive biases. But the real risk is that if you strongly believe in soulmates and start to encounter some problems in your relationship, you know, everybody encounters problems in relationships, right? So if you start to encounter some of those problems, that might make you doubt that you're with your soulmate. So So I'd say like the kind of summary of what I see from the research on soulmate beliefs is that if you're confident your partner is your soulmate, then everything's fine. It's great. But as soon as things make you maybe question whether your partner is truly compatible or the one for you, that's where we start to see those beliefs become more detrimental.
And what about sexual growth or destiny beliefs?
Right. Yeah. So I developed kind of the concept of applying these concepts to the sexual domain. So I'm sure a lot of your listeners will be familiar with, I feel like it's all over the place these days, the idea of a growth mindset. So this is great work that was done by Carol Dweck and her colleagues. And so this idea of a growth versus fixed mindset, or it's sometimes called incremental entity, but this idea of an incremental growth mindset was applied to relationships. Like I was mentioning, the ideas of destiny versus growth, or soulmate beliefs versus growth beliefs. And then I tried to make this more specific to the sexual domain, because I really noticed that some people seem to have the belief that sexual compatibility should be really evident right away, that you need to have a real spark, whereas other folks tended to have more of like a practical belief that sexual satisfaction just kind of comes from a lot of effort and hard work. So now there's a growing body of literature from some colleagues around the world all doing similar work. We use slightly different scales, but essentially we're all applying that fundamental idea of do you think you can change something versus do you think it's fixed to the sexual domains. In my case, whether you can change sexual satisfaction. Other researchers have looked at whether you believe you can change sexual desire or attraction, or I think there's even a few others that I'm forgetting, but really there's kind of now this growing body of research looking at those beliefs in the sexual domain. And I can just kind of go over what I find in my work that is echoing what others find as well. Really, it comes down to the fact that believing in sexual growth, believing that you can change your sex life, is associated with more positive outcomes. So in my studies, you know, I've done lots of studies now, and in a meta-analysis across 5 of my studies, I show that there's this moderate association between if you believe in sexual growth beliefs, you tend to report higher sexual satisfaction and higher relationship satisfaction. And not only that, but if I believe in sexual growth beliefs, that can benefit my partner above and beyond their own beliefs. And what I was really excited about is I've been able to show that growth beliefs can be helpful even in situations that are really challenging for people's relationships and sex lives. So, you know, when people have become new parents, or females who are experiencing sexual interest and arousal disorder, breast cancer patients, things like that. So I think that's, to me, kind of showing the real world power of just like having this mindset that you can work on things and that your sex life, like all areas of a relationship, requires a little bit of tending to an effort.
Yeah, I read in, I think it was a while ago, in a Pew Research study from 2007, that people rated as sex being more important to their relationship than their partner's religious beliefs.
Yes, yeah. So I'm familiar with that study too. I often use it to start off talks because I like kind of try to shock people a little bit, saying like more people rate a sex life as very important to marriage than things like having similar political beliefs, sharing interests, adequate income, things like that. So people's sex lives are just a really important part of their relationships and overall well-being. And we've seen a ton of research on this in the field over the past decade or two. I like to also pull out, there's some studies showing that if you poll people multiple times a day, asking what they're up to and how happy they are, sex is the activity that actually leads to the most happiness day to day, even more so than things like having dinner or leisure time or socializing with friends. So that's kind of one of the fundamentals of my research, is this idea that sex does hold a special place in relationships. And it is really critical to the quality of our overall relationship, and also just our life satisfaction, lower depressive symptoms, happy mood, all of those really important things.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So in the meantime, while you are looking for a soulmate, if you're experiencing anxiety about finding a soulmate, is there a way to reduce your anxiety about ending up single or in a loveless marriage?
Yeah, I feel like that's a great question. I think one of the main things is I would encourage people to, just based on my research and other research, I have a lot of thoughts, but I'll try to keep them organized. So the main thing I would say is do your best to just kind of question your idea of whether there is a soulmate, right? So if you believe in more that idea of growth, that you can make relationships work with different types of people, that can maybe make you more satisfied down the line. And I like to remind people that what you think your ideal partner looks like might not actually translate to who you connect with. So one of my favorite studies looked at people before they went on a speed dating study and then actually at the speed dating event. And what they found was that what you said you valued in a partner before the event didn't actually translate to who you pick at the actual event. And I think this has been echoed now in several different types of studies using different methodologies. But what we find in our field is that people aren't very good at knowing with whom they're going to connect with. So I think if someone's single, I would just try to encourage them to have a little bit more of an open mind, right? Like you might think it's really important to you for your partner to like the same music as you, but really that might not be optimal for relationship success. And maybe if you just gave someone a chance and let things grow, it could work out. And then I want to definitely tap into the idea of like fearing being single. And so my colleagues have Steph Spielman, and I've contributed to some of this work as well. What we found is that people who really have that anxiety over being single, and this is something you can even feel even if you're currently in a relationship, but the more concerned you are about being alone, it can lead to some negative consequences. So for instance, it might lead you to show interest in mates who are suboptimal. We found in one study, for instance, that if you really are concerned about being alone, you're going to show a lot of romantic interest in a dating profile, even when this person is showing cues they would not really be responsive, like they're a little bit of a jerk, essentially. We also see if you really fear being single, you're going to stay more committed to a crappier relationship. So I just like to remind people, like, having those beliefs and kind of feeling like you're going to be alone can really undermine your actual chances of relationship success. And there's so much growing work now showing that people can be happy single. I try to remind single folks that I meet that, like, enjoy this time. It can be a time of growth. And being so nervous about being alone can actually sabotage your chances of having a good relationship. So do your best to remember there's lots of fish in the sea and enjoy the single moment for now.
I was also always fascinated with how, like, monks and ascetics deal without having romantic partners in their lives. And is there a way to, like, psychologically reduce, let's say, your levels of desire for a partner or sexual desire even?
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I would say that, I mean, it's very natural to want human connection. So, like, I wouldn't necessarily encourage people to decrease that need. But what I would say is we can get our social needs met in a variety of ways, right? So our belongingness needs, our social needs, it doesn't have to be just from a romantic partner. And in fact, even if you're in a romantic relationship, I encourage you to not put all those needs in one basket, right? So the broader your social network, the better. So I would encourage people, if they're, say, currently single and not with a romantic partner, one way they can maybe reduce some of that fear of being single or that, like, kind of drive for just a romantic partner is to remember that friends, siblings, acquaintances, family, like all of those things can really help satiate some of the same needs that we have for human connection. And so there's lots of different ways you can get your social needs met that don't necessarily involve a romantic partner. And I would say the same for sexual needs as well, right? So I wouldn't necessarily say that we need to, like, reduce someone's sexual desire, but probably what I would say is that reminding single folks that there's lots of ways they can meet their sexual needs through, like, solo sex, you know, sex with robots, even if we want to get crazy, or more just generally, you know, casual sex. So I feel like there's ways to get people's social and emotional as well as sexual needs met in ways that aren't always with a romantic partner. And I think it's just important to remember that all of these are really natural desires. And so, like, I wouldn't urge people to necessarily try to, like, tamp them down.
You mentioned casual sex. So what is the impact of casual sex and what should casual sex be used for?
There was a lot of concern about casual sex maybe about a decade ago. There's a lot of articles about, like, how hookup culture on campus is ruining relationships and things like that. And for every study that found that casual sex had a negative effect, there'd be a study finding that casual sex could have a positive effect on your relationships and your well-being. And now finally, we're starting to see a little bit more nuance in the literature and finding things that it might depend on your motivations for casual sex and some of your individual personality traits. So for instance, if you're someone who has the attitude that casual sex is okay and sex without love is okay, then actually engaging in casual sex doesn't necessarily have cost. It actually can be good for you. So on weeks when people who have those beliefs have casual sex, they're actually happier. So the effects of casual sex are very much not one size fits all. And so what to kind of synthesize across a lot of different studies, I'd say what it really comes down to is that having casual sex is something you're doing autonomously and you're doing it because it's in line with your values. So the only times we tend to see kind of more costs for casual sex are when people are doing it because of peer pressure, because they feel like they have to, or they are engaging in casual sex and that's very much not in line with their values. But in general, I'd say for the most part, having casual sex is usually rated as more of a positive experience than a negative experience by folks. And I would also remind people that there's a wide spectrum of casual sex, right? So that can range, like that term can often be used from everything from a one-night stand to like a long-term friends with benefits. And so there are some differences between the different types of casual sex relationships.
How does your attachment style impact your view, like your views or your experience of casual sex?
Yeah, so I was able to contribute to some research on that. So more broadly, there's research showing that more avoidant focused people, so these are for your listeners, these are people who kind of really like independence in their relationships. They don't particularly value closeness. They are worried about trusting other people. So these people tend to have more positive views of casual sex in general. Whereas we don't see necessarily the same kind of pro-casual sex views amongst people who are more secure or more anxious or clingy in their relationships. But then what I did with my student when I was at the University of Toronto is we looked at how different forms of casual sex might interact with your attachment style to predict things like your pleasure after the event and just kind of your regret and your emotions afterwards. And what we found was that for those more avoidant focused people who have trouble with closeness and trust, they actually seemed to have the best outcomes when they were engaged in sex buddy relationships. So these are, you know, when they're having sex with kind of casual acquaintances repeatedly, but it's not getting too intimate. And it seemed like for them, a friends with benefit relationship was actually possibly too intimate. So what ourselves and others have found is that friends with benefit relationships are really quite similar to relationships in a lot of ways. When it comes to attachment styles, the avoidant people were really valuing those relationships that are a little bit more casual than a very intimate friends with benefit relationship, but not so casual like a one-night stand. And I think part of that is because there's other research showing that repeated sexual experiences with the same person end up being more satisfying and pleasurable because the person tends to know more what you like and things like that. So yeah, attachment styles can really affect why we go into casual sex experiences and the ultimate outcomes as well.
Perfect. That's really interesting. Recently, I've been reading Anna Karenina, and I found that a common trope in the romantic genre was that the protagonist or one of the people has someone who is nice and good and is a good partner and it might even be physically attractive, but the character, the protagonist, falls in love with someone else and they can't explain why. And this is also like a source of strife in their life. So I wanted to ask, is there a way to change whom you're romantically attracted to?
Ooh, I think the answer is like, probably not. Yes and no. It's a great question, right? Because I think we can, like I was talking about growth beliefs, right? You can work on a relationship. I don't think you can always necessarily work to improve your sexual attraction to someone if you're very much not attracted to them. But I think if there's kind of a small spark, you can really work to like grow that into a flame.
Can you give us like one or two examples maybe of how someone might do this?
Yeah, well, I guess I'm just thinking that you might not always be super, let's say, physically attracted to someone, or maybe you're not sure and you're like just friends first. But if you try it out, your love and attraction could grow. So I think part of this is just getting to know someone more. You start to become more intimate and learn more about them. And so that can really foster greater feelings of connection. And that can end up leading to things like more physical attractions. As you start to do things like going on exciting dates, learning deep things about them, those all are things that predict greater desire and greater passion. But it's not going to be able to happen if you're completely unattracted to someone or really don't see the value. I think this idea is really fascinating, right? And we do see it in media a lot that like we kind of can't explain who we're attracted to. And I think that really can frustrate people, but it also is something that is coming through in the literature that even though we can know a lot of traits about you and about your partner, we don't really know why two people click more than others. So even when I've done research with speed dating studies, we find that it's the unique compatibility that's really important for predicting who gets together after speed dating, who wants to date. But like, it's very hard to predict why those two people click above and beyond just like that person being attractive and that person liking a lot of people. So I feel like as a science, we're still working towards figuring out exactly why two people click and have that chemistry. And so surprisingly, the idea of romantic and sexual chemistry is not as well studied as you might think. I mean, I haven't read Anna Karenina, but in similar cases too, sometimes I think it comes down to a person's own situation. So it's like, maybe if someone is not ready for a romantic relationship, they're actually going to pick you know, they're going to eschew a really safe, good option because they're afraid of intimacy. So sometimes I think these cases could be because the person themselves is avoidantly attached and they're shying away from what would be a very secure type relationship and kind of repeating their patterns by getting into these exciting things. I also think oftentimes people mistake anxiety for passion. So I think we often think that a safe, secure relationship is a boring relationship because sometimes there's other people who, you know, are playing hot and cold and they're more, maybe there's more intrigue and things like that. But really, I think that's setting us up for more of a short-term relationship. And so I think if you're thinking long-term, going for the good, safe option is maybe more important, but I think it depends on whether the person themselves is ready. And one of my favorite kind of concepts that came out of relationship science in recent years that I feel like doesn't get enough attention is just this idea of commitment readiness. So just like how much the person's own readiness to commit to a long-term relationship might factor into their decision. So kind of the idea of timing, if you will. So I feel like the idea of timing could be something that's playing into all of these. I would say it's like, it's going to take work and effort, right? And it's something that you have to be willing to do.
What is something that we should know when we're picking out a partner?
I would say the main thing that I would look for in a partner that might predict relationship success is responsiveness. So this is when a partner shows that they're, it's like three parts, like caring, validating, and understanding. And so responsive partners are just going to make your relationship better. They're going to make you feel better about yourself. They're going to be caring. They're going to respond to conflict in a positive way and just all of kind of the good things I feel like someone who's responsive will do. And responsiveness is highly correlated with things like attachment security. So to give an example of what a responsive partner would look like that's someone who is comfortable with their emotions. Someone who listens when you speak, right? Someone who, even if they have a different opinion from you, is really still engaging with your thoughts and validating your thoughts and worldview. And just someone who, in general is just kind of caring, right? And so I think that again, especially when people are younger, they might look for kind of like there's lots of tropes, right? Like looking for the bad boy or the bad girl, but really the nice, caring people tend to be more responsive and that's going to be just setting you up for relationship success. So I don't know if I was concrete enough there, but I feel like those are kind of like the three pillars of responsiveness, showing care, validation, and understanding.
Perfect. Perfect. Okay. And then my final question is, how can we maintain love and sexual satisfaction during a relationship?
There's so many different ways, right? That's great. Like I could, I can and do often go on about this topic for hours, but I think what it can come down to is prioritizing intimacy, which can look like prioritizing deep conversations with your partner, prioritizing quality time, or it could look like prioritizing physical intimacy and affection. And I think one of the best ways to kind of get at this is the idea of self-expansion. So this comes down to the idea of making sure you still do things with your partner that are going to help you learn new things about them. Because when we learn new things about our partner, that really increases our feelings of passion towards them. So this could be like anything from like, just switch up the restaurant you go to with your partner. Maybe find some of those kind of dorky relationship games online where you ask each other intimate questions. It could be something more elaborate, like going on an adventurous date or going on vacation. But all of those things can really help us see our partner in a new light. And that is so important then to make us feel that deeper connection, remind us of the falling in love stage, and really just make us closer as partners and feel that passion again, because it can be really difficult to maintain things like sexual desire and passion in a long-term relationship if you're not putting in that effort to try to kind of keep things fresh.
What happens if we think that we know everything about someone?
Yeah. So I love this idea. And this is really related to what Esther Perel talks a lot about. And she's like a kind of famous relationship couples counselor. So familiarity in a lot of ways feels like at odds from sexual desire and intimacy. And it can get to the place that if we feel too comfortable or familiar with our partner, we feel like a little bit bored, essentially, right? So learning new things with your partner, having a little bit of mystery can help you feel more connected and more attracted, because feeling overfamiliar is something that a lot of people mention in qualitative studies about why they're feeling less passion for their partner, right? It's like, okay, well, there's no more, you know, romance really in a way, because you know everything about your partner. Maybe you're living in the same space, you kind of see them all day long. So a little bit of distance or separation can be helpful really as well here. But I like the idea of kind of when we can learn more new things about our partner, it makes them feel new to us in a way. And that's just something that humans just love, right? This craving for novelty and to always feel like we're growing. So when you can see your partner in a new light and learn something new, it just kind of reminds you that, like, yeah, there's still more to learn here. And that can make us really feel good and feel that passion.
Perfect. Okay. So thank you, Dr. Maxwell, for coming on today. And is there anywhere that students can look to find out more about you, like the website?
Oh, yes. Yes. So they can follow me on Twitter at Jess_A_Maxwell, or they can follow my professional Instagram. That's at maxwell.psych. That's maxwell.psyc on Instagram. And I do have a personal website, jessmaxwell.com. I don't always update it as often as I should, but it's got the foundational stuff there.
And if you wanted someone to remember three key points from this podcast, what would they be?
Three key takeaways from the podcast I want people to remember is, one, it's important to remember that we need to work on our relationships and put time and effort to maintain them. Two, don't be afraid about being single or get overly focused on finding the one, because actually there's the ones, there's lots of different people. And third, if you want to keep your relationship successful long-term, try to bring in some novelty to keep that spark alive.
Perfect. So thank you so much for taking the time to meet with me, Dr. Maxwell. And that's it for this week of SciSection. Make sure to check our podcast available on global platforms for our latest interviews.